and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. All right, here we
blah,
go.
Blah, 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 blah.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning, lurking conservatives, you heinous asses. How are you? Can't stand you. Cannot stand the conservatives anymore, Riley. Throwing around this picture of a parking lot filled with buses, with school buses that are half submerged, saying that's proof that it was the state's fault. You know what? This government has failed on so many levels, my friends, my conservatives. Conservative friends, one of whom emailed me yesterday, Riley, I've known for years, emailed me just to declare his racism, which is being brought out in mass by the accusations of this being the local government's fault. This government, this administration has failed, and you can tell primarily by the fact that Rove has put in place a plan to try to damage control, as opposed to trying to help out, you know, days before the hurricane, which it should have. They are now trying to damage control the administration by creating some sort of Rovian tour of the disaster area for all officials who feel like going down there. This government is, it shouldn't be called a government. All it should be called is some sort of sports team. They are bad at governing, and all they care about is politics and winning, as do their minions. Hence the picture of the school buses submerged being, you know, sort of emailed around and put up on conservative blogs as being proof that the city could have evacuated itself. Well, who's going to drive the school buses, number one? And does that just mean that the federal government can sit there and go, I don't know whose fault it was. Someone should have driven the buses. You guys are morons, and your argument is shallow. And the water there is not so shallow either. It wouldn't have been so easy to get those school buses out. 200 school buses, 60 people per bus. You know, how many does that add up to? How many is that? About 12,000 people?
Where could they have put the school buses so they would have been dry enough to operate in the first place?
Right. 12,000 people, though. What does that do to 100,000 people that need to be evacuated? Nothing. It's ridiculous. You people should be ashamed of yourself.
I think
you
it's
hate
only 1,200, actually. Is
yeah.
it 1,200?
How you doing? No, it would be 1,200, yeah. 60 times 200, 12. No, it's not 1,200. It is 1,200, yeah. 12,000. What are we?
Is it 1,200 or 12,000?
Are we stupid? Are we stupid? 200. It's 12,000 people. 12,000 people, three zeros, my friends. Hey, Chris, I brought you this.
You're right.
I knew I was right to begin with, and you said, wait a minute. And then I'm like, well, maybe you're right.
No, because I thought when we were on the call yesterday, we said 1,200.
It's 12,000 people.
12,000, yeah.
But either way, that's not the issue. The issue is that proves nothing. It proves nothing. The plans that should have been in place weren't in place. FEMA dropped the ball. The administration dropped the ball. And it's all very clear to everyone. And then there are still people, you know, suffering. There's a lot of stuff going on in New Orleans now. Some progress has been made. Chris Lopresto, I don't mean to change the subject, but I brought you this DVD. I want you to watch it. This is Downfall. This is a German film about Hitler's last days in the bunker. It is one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. I want it back because I have a Downfall obsession. I need to watch it over and over and over again. Good morning, Mark Riley. I'm sorry I got off on such a huge tirade right at the beginning, but I had to sort of spew that because I think that is going to be the running theme of what we're going to be talking about here. Again, I want to thank Dan Pashman and Brendan McDonald for manning the ship last week. They did a great job.
Absolutely.
I am happy to be back, happy to be in it, happy to be working again, actually. Even the hours aren't bothering me. I was excited. You know how jacked up I was? That's on no sugar. Well, actually, it's not true. Chris and I were eating out of the garbage.
That's true.
How pathetic is that?
Wait a minute. Out of what garbage?
Well, there was some food there. I don't even know when the food happened.
Oh, that was sometime yesterday afternoon. Probably.
All right, so that's not too bad. A box of donuts from yesterday afternoon isn't too bad.
A box of donuts on top of a crate of chicken wings.
Half-eaten chicken.
And Oreos and cookies
in
the
lunchroom. Right, yeah, they treat us right here. You know, you can just always go into the lunchroom and pick through someone else's garbage. What's wrong with us? What's when we can't order a box of donuts? Are we in some sort of denial? We got to eat out of the garbage? We're eating Entenmann's Munchkins out of the garbage. Good morning. How are you? It's great. It's great. All right. So let's get into some of the. I think what we should talk about, Riley, is some of the positive, perhaps, positive things that are happening in New Orleans. Their water has begun to be pumped out. Levels of water are significantly lower. They've gone down from like 80% in depth and height to
about 60%.
They were able to shore up that 200-foot hole in that wall that created most of the flooding in the bowl that is New Orleans. They've shored that up with sandbags and concrete blocks. The Army Corps of Engineers have dropping sandbags for days, and now they've gotten some pumps up and working. Which is good. That means some of the water. And Mayor Ray Nagin of New Orleans has warned that as good as this is, he sees a ray of light on the horizon. But you know what could be revealed as this water goes down could be grisly, could be sad. It will be. An estimate of 10,000 people could be dead. This is something that we're going to be finding out in the next few days.
And the mayor has now said that anyone left inside New Orleans will be forcibly evacuated. Those forcible evacuations have not yet begun to take place. The police department in New Orleans, with one-third of their people missing in action, apparently are not prepared to do this. But the mayor has ordered that everyone be evacuated. And it is good news, and I think a tribute to the people who actually did the work on the ground to shore up that wall, to do this work, to start pumping this stuff out. This is a tribute to their, and a testament to their work ethic, unlike our administration in this instance.
Despite the failure of the government to really show up for the people of New Orleans, and we're going to get into some of the issues that added to that, one of them being, subcontracting, the move towards the privatizing of government in this country, the move towards subcontracting everything to private industry has really failed in this case and fails in most cases, but that is the plan of the right wing. That is the Republican plan, is to privatize all services. So that means there's another layer of bureaucracy. This is the party that claims small government, but yet they keep creating bureaucracies that keep polluting the chain of command. And then, who's going to answer for it? What they've designed is a system in which blame just sort of keeps going and going and going until they hope it dissipates. But it's not going to dissipate this time, Riley.
No, it's not. And the contrivance that the Bush administration has put together to respond to this. First of all, to bring certain cabinet members, Condoleezza Rice and others, Richard Myers, to the affected areas. All of these things that we're seeing take place, including, by the way, the blame dispersal, is all out of the mind of Karl Rove. I guess the whole blame scandal is gone from everyone's memory, so no one asks anymore why he's still in his job, but this is his job. His job was to develop a political response to a human tragedy. People need to not lose sight of that fact. Everything that we have seen take place, including the blogging, including the columns in the newspapers that are trying to blame Ray Nagin and Kathleen Blanco and everybody else but Bush for this, all of this is contrived. When Michael Chertoff got up there and said, well, this is the federal government's job is to come in and support after the fact. State and local officials have the first responsibility. That came from Rove. That didn't come from Chertoff.
Yes, they are all in Rove-controlled spin mode. They are focused completely on damage control. They are not on the ground. They are not on the ground, doing what needs to be done. Karl Rove is sitting in his little world. He and his lieutenant, communications director Dan Bartlett, are orchestrating perpetual Republican publicity tours of storm zone damage. All right, because Bush was there on Monday. You had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers, was there over the weekend. Rumsfeld was there over the weekend. Condoleezza Rice was there, probably wearing her new shoes. Chatting to the victims about Spam-a-Lot. On Thursday, apparently, Big Dick Cheney is dragging his sick black heart down to the death zone he helped create to make friends and maybe oversee some reconstruction project that he might be part of the subcontracting of. And it's got to be bad if they're taking Dick Cheney out of the hospital, that is his house, taking him off the machine.
Yeah, he was in Wyoming. Nobody had heard a word out of him.
Yeah.
And, it's amazing on several levels here when you start looking at some of the statements that have been made, that Chertoff and Brown had no idea that there were any evacuees in the New Orleans Convention Center. That's absurd.
It's mind-blowing to me that, that what's happening now is that they have been directed by Karl Rove, who should be, hung out to dry for perjury, as we all know. But they have been directed by Karl Rove. It is a directive that says it includes instructions to not even acknowledge criticisms or attacks on the administration for their failures. Don't even acknowledge it. That's what the talking points are. All you're supposed to do, I mean, this is like, they are guilty of murder through negligence. That's my belief. And just a completely irresponsible bungling of you know, treating and saving and helping, you know, thousands and thousands of Americans who were in deep trouble. And they are instructed not to talk about any criticism, not to react to any criticism, but only talk about what's being done now. Well, I'll tell you what's being done now. It's not enough, and it's never going to be enough in relation to the failures that they made initially. And that's just the way I believe it. When we come back here in just a few minutes, you know, we can talk about, you know, some of the you know, the mistakes that were made, number one, and some of the stuff, also some of this privatizing stuff, and also that, you know, now Bush is putting together, they're going to have a congressional investigation into this.
Yeah.
But he's also going to have a separate investigation. I guess he's going to sit in a room by himself and ask himself probing questions. We'll get into a little of that. I want to tell you a little bit about Friday. We've got a big show coming up Friday at the New School Tisch Auditorium with Stephen Colbert. I'll give you the details on that in a second. Good morning. I'm all amped up. I hope I didn't jar you. 16 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Lawton Smalls, Morning Sedition's Planet Bush Bureau Chief. You know why I'm praying for you? Because you're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
These are leaders who won re-election last year largely by portraying their opponents as incapable of keeping this country safe. These are leaders who regularly pressure the news media in this country to report the reopening of a school or a power station in Iraq, and which regularly defies its citizens not to stand up and cheer when something like that is accomplished. Yet they couldn't even keep one school or power station from being devastated by infrastructure collapse in New Orleans, even though the government had heard all the chatter from the scientists and city planners and hurricane centers, and some group whose purposes the government couldn't quite discern, a group called the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Most chillingly of all, this is the law and order and terror government. It promised protection, or at least amelioration, against all threats, conventional, radiological, or biological. It has just proved that it cannot save its citizens from a biological weapon called standing water. For many of this country's citizens, the mantra has been, as we were taught in social studies, it should always be, whether or not I voted for this president, he is still my president. I suspect anybody who had to give him that benefit of the doubt stopped doing so last week. I suspect also a lot of his supporters, looking ahead to 08, are wondering how they can distance themselves from the two words which will define his government, our government, New Orleans.
That was Keith Olbermann from commentary from his MSNBC show on Monday night. You know, a lot of reporters did an amazing job in actually expressing their feelings and doing some honest-to-God journalism and not stifling themselves in reaction to this and calling it what it is, a tremendous failure at all levels of government. I want to clear some stuff up about what I was talking about before in this picture of a parking lot of school buses that has been sort of, you know, moving along the conservative blogs and being emailed to conservatives, is that their point is, that given that there were 200 buses sitting in a parking lot, school buses, that those buses should have been mobilized before the storm in order to take people out, evacuate people, as Riley and I decided, you know, after, you know, moments of speculation to the equation of 200 times,
yeah,
times,
right, 60, times 60,
that would only make 12,000 people to be evacuated, and that's, you know, about 80,000 too short. And that's not even the point. The point is that where was the support? The support was asked for. The federal government needs to be there to support any catastrophic situation. That's what FEMA was designed to do. This was not a state government situation. This was a national crisis. And the idea that Senator Mary Landrieu did not ask for help, or that the Governor Blanco did not ask for help, is just a lie. It's just a lie. We have a letter here from the state of Louisiana from Governor Blanco. And right out here it says, right, Dear Mr. President, under the provisions of Section 401 of the Robert T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act, I request that you declare expedited major disaster for the state of Louisiana as Hurricane Katrina, a Category 5 hurricane, approaches our coast south of New Orleans beginning on August 28th, 2005, and continuing. All right? This was before the storm, my friends. A preliminary damage assessment, I'm quoting from the letter, a preliminary damage assessment will be conducted as soon as possible after the landfall of Hurricane Katrina. Based on the predictions we have received from the National Weather Service and other sources, I've determined that this incident will be of such severity and magnitude that effective response will be beyond the capabilities of the state and the affected local governments, and that supplementary federal assistance will be necessary, end quote. So, you know, for conservatives to start, you know, pointing fingers like this and, you know, and letting their government off the hook. It's heinous. It's hate mongering. This isn't a game. There are people with lives at stake here. I mean, I can't understand the mentality, Riley. When did this country, especially fueled by the right, look at government, at politics, as some sort of sporting event that needs to be won at any cost? Are these people that shallow? Are they in that much denial? Are they filled with that much suppressed anger that all this looks like to them is some sort of a game on a board in Vegas?
What they are seeing and what the American people are seeing, Mark, is George W. Bush and his administration separating politics from government. And this is something that, unless we get a really enlightened successor to Bush in 2008, is going to continue to take place. Bush, at a certain point, was less interested in how those relief efforts were going than he was about how those relief efforts reflected on him. Remember, he went to that area on Friday, and Republican leaders came back and said, you know what, you did a really bad job. That's why he went back on Monday. This is all a political contrivance. Those 200 buses underwater, Michael Chertoff, all of it. Because if it wasn't, we would know right now, this very minute, who it was within the White House who is going to be the person that says when power is going to be restored,
right,
when these jobs are going to be
right,
done, when people are going to be coming back. We don't hear a word about any of this.
Yeah, but what we have heard is that the president and members of Congress have pledged to get to the bottom of the government's failings through separate investigations. The Congress will use the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. The president will sit in a room by himself asking himself probing questions, but doubtfully coming up with any answers that implicate his part of it. Bill Frist said the response to the hurricane needs to be first and foremost after the estate tax and the Roberts confirmation October.
Oh, yeah.
But we'll get to it. You know, we'll get to it. Harry Reid says that the cost of the recovery and relief operation, Senator Harry Reid, the Senate Minority Leader, said could exceed $150 billion. So we're going to get into a little more of that. Obviously, we're going to be talking about the hurricane. I'll give you the details on this Friday's live broadcast in just a second. It's 27 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Hey, stay tuned tomorrow. We got a big announcement to make. All right? It's nothing negative. We're not going off the air. We're not leaving. We're not moving our time spot, but it's going to be exciting. How do you like that? Look forward to that, the big announcement tomorrow. Isn't that weird? I'm just teasing a big announcement today ahead of time. Tomorrow,
big announcement.
Look, our next live broadcast will be our biggest ever, folks. We're going to be broadcasting from the New School this Friday. We'll have former Senator Bob Kerrey on, and The Daily Show's Stephen Colbert will be there performing live. We'll be in the same theater that once housed inside the Actors Studio and served as a site for some of the 9/11 Commission hearings. It's the New School's Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street, just east of 6th Avenue, this Friday from 6 to 9 a.m. We got Sarah Jones.
Yeah, give the sister some love.
She's very good. I met her out in Aspen. was out there when I was doing my one-person show, Jerusalem Syndrome. She was also out there doing her one-person show. Want to thank Ray in Minnesota. Ray, he says also as a P.S. here, please touch Pops Riley for me just once. Ray sent us this huge, a massive box of about 10 different types of popcorn that you can pop, in some of it including marshmallow packets and caramel packets. So, Kayla, if you want to go up and grab yourself a marshmallow packet.
Why are you going to put that on poor Chris?
Because we're eating donuts out of the garbage earlier. It was sad. Ray in Minnesota, he sent a lot of nice swag. I can't even say his last name or where he's from because he sent us some good stuff, and I don't know where it came from. All kinds of little iPod accessories. He did guilt me a little bit into getting a bigger iPod, but that's all right, man. I appreciate the gesture. It's very nice to come home from vacation to a huge box of microwave popcorn, some of it involving caramel and marshmallows that I'm afraid of. But I'm gonna probably do it. I'm having a little trouble. I'm on a slippery slope with sugar right now.
Uh-oh.
Hey, you know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, my friends, we have the iNews Wi-Fi headline translator right here. Let's kick it up and feed it some headlines. You can hear Brendan McDonald do that live at the News School this Friday. From the Miami Herald, Bush now spending time on hurricane relief. Bush now spending time on hurricane relief. Translation, Karl Rove now spending time on Bush's hurricane relief image. From San Francisco Chronicle, Bush, Clinton announce hurricane fund. Bush, Clinton announce hurricane fund. Translation, comedians dust off jokes involving Clinton and the word blow. Let's feed that through again. So I'm getting the weird kind of, like, I'm getting the throaty Kalo laugh. All right, here it is. This is another translation for Bush Clinton announced hurricane fund. Leaderless nation turns to ex-presidents for help. one more time.
Oh, no.
Come on, there's a few funny ones. Bush Clinton announced hurricane fund. Again, grown-ups called to mop up Junior's mess. Hey, come on. Hey, yeah. All right, from the Associated Press, kids may mimic parents smoking and drinking. Kids may mimic parents smoking and drinking. Translation, 5 minutes added to school lunches for smoke break. All right, enough funny. Let's get back into the storm. So I thank Ray. We did that. I just wanted people to understand something about hurricane relief and when it's done correctly. When Hurricane Ivan, a Category 5 storm, hit Cuba in 2004, the Castro government, abetted by neighborhood citizens committees, evacuated 1.5 million people, more than 10% of the country's population. The Cubans lost 20,000 homes to that hurricane, but not a single life was lost. This is an amazing feat that has gone largely unmentioned here because, you know, it's Cuba. And God forbid we throw a bone to a communist country for actually being more efficient than our country. And I guess critics will say, well, that's what happens when governments run everything. Well, I'd just like this government to have a plan in place to let us all know what has to be done, where we have to go, and to be there before it happens, especially when you've been warned a million times. Another person, country that is very good at hurricane relief was this country when Bill Clinton was president.
Mm-hmm.
Calling Hurricane Floyd one of the most serious hurricanes ever to threaten the United States, President Clinton issued disaster declarations for Florida and Georgia in anticipation. Anticipation.
Wasn't that what Governor Blanco was asking for?
Yes, that's exactly what she was asking for, Riley. Anticipation of the destruction the storm may wreak on the southeastern U.S. coast. And also, it's an interesting thing to note that presidents, they make a practice of visiting the sites of major disasters to review relief operations and comfort victims. But Bill Clinton, he delayed his visit because he didn't want it to interfere with the logistics, he didn't want his visit, the logistics of his visit, to interfere with relief efforts, which is something that this administration cares nothing about.
Yeah.
And one of the big issues, Riley, I think we should talk about in terms of, we were talking about this on the phone a little bit, in terms of how this administration works and what Republicanism in its current form really looks like. Because I was thinking about the comments that George Bush made about spinning the disaster into saying that it's going to look great when we rebuild it. Trent Lott's porch. He's going to build a new house. I'm going to sit on his porch and watch black people in trouble.
Yeah.
But what I want to know is that this is another part of the failing on behalf of this government is that FEMA privatized hurricane disaster plans, you know, to a firm with political ties to the Republicans, of course, in June 2004. Mm-hmm. FEMA outsourced the development of a catastrophic hurricane disaster plan for southeastern Louisiana. The more than $500,000 contract was granted to IEM, Innovative Emergency Management Incorporated, a Baton Rouge-based emergency management and homeland security consultant. This is the big problem with the Homeland Security, is that Homeland Security was initially set up as sort of a kind of operative slush fund to funnel money into the pockets of security contractors. Right?
Well, security contractors who also give money to Republican politicians, and specifically to Bush's election and re-election campaigns.
But see, this is a failure on behalf of this Republican ideal, of this free market ideal, of this privatization ideal, of this smaller government idea. The government cannot be smaller when it comes to to saving people's lives in catastrophic situations in this country, because now what do? They just continue to displace blame all the way down to maybe the guy who works in the broom closet of this company that was subcontracted to do the work to put a plan in place to save New Orleans.
Well, see, what I think they're probably going to start doing is refocusing. They're going to refocus on John Roberts. They're going to refocus on the estate tax. Anything about gay marriage comes up, they're, of course, going to refocus on that. They're going to go and see, again, this is Rove's methodology. Focus on stuff that your base is passionate about and hope that everybody else forgets about Katrina, forgets about the plane scandal, forgets about everything else that this administration, forgets about Iraq for them. How much have you heard about Iraq since Katrina hit?
Yeah, I understand that. And also, it just seems to me to be the logical extension of the adapt-or-die policies of the Republican administration, the idea that privatization will work in any situation when it comes to social programs or subcontracting out plans for hurricane emergency management. It goes right along the lines with legislating tort legislation,
yeah.
Restricting victims' rights. Okay, this means that individuals cannot sue corporations for more than a certain amount of money, or maybe not at all. They're going to make it very difficult. They're going to make it. They made it impossible for people to declare personal bankruptcy. This is a government and an administration that favors corporations over individuals at all costs and on all levels. It has failed, and that failing has become completely evident in the sewage soup that is now New Orleans, and it's going to become completely evident in the future in terms of how these displaced people are going to get back. I know why people don't want to leave their houses, Riley, because they don't think they're going to be able to come back.
Yeah, and there are some people who are gone who will say out front they're not going to come back. But the scary thing about this, Mark, is that, and this is a report from NBC News, actually, these people, some of the people that predicted what was going to happen with Hurricane Katrina, or any kind of a Category 3 and above hurricane hitting the Gulf Coast,
uh-huh,
they were laughed at by FEMA. There's a guy, and I don't want to mispronounce his name, he's from Louisiana State University, Ivor Van Heerden.
Yeah.
A researcher.
Right.
Who, when they were trying to present this information, they had a scenario called Hurricane Pam.
Right.
120-mile-an-hour winds, massive storm surge, 20 feet of water in the city, 80% of the buildings damaged, refugees on rooftops, and possible gun violence that could slow the rescue. This was all in a scenario prior to Katrina. And when they tried to present this scenario to FEMA, people just sort of snickered. According to Ivor Van Heerden, those FEMA, and I'm quoting, those FEMA officials wouldn't listen to me. Those Corps of Engineers people giggled in the back of the room when we tried to present information.
Well, that's because at that time, Riley, I mean, this is the interesting thing, is that this is a government, as Keith Olbermann was saying on his NBC show, this is all about security. So out of the 200 and some odd, a government document that NBC got hold of that is dated June 2004 lists something like 222 pending FEMA tests, the Hurricane Pam scenario being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. These are homeland security exercises to help prepare people for national emergencies. Now, only two of them involved hurricanes, and more specifically, terrorist attacks associated with hurricanes. So Hurricane Pam, that scenario was attached to probably a terrorist attack, since only two of these things dealt with hurricanes, and that was only in relation to a terrorist attack happening after a hurricane. So in my head, being that I am a bit conspiratorial, not as much as I used to be, this seems like a win-win for this administration. The terrorist attack would guarantee their control over a frightened populace, and the hurricane would guarantee business and building contracts. See, on some level, you have to think about that. You listen to Denny Hastert's comments. He's saying, why bother? You listen to George Bush. On some level, these guys think this is great for the economy, all right? Because as you'll notice, all the oil refineries, most of them, or at least a few of them, are up and running. The ones that supply the entire eastern seaboard with oil, those pipelines are functioning. But that, you know, half a million people still don't have electricity. You know, but they've got this oil operation up and running, and now they've got, you know, they're starting to get building contracts for what's going to be the new New Orleans. On some level, these sick bastards think that this is just evolution.
Even though
they claim not to believe in it, they say that, you know, look, we've cleaned the slate. Who cares where the hell these people end up? That's why we have faith-based initiatives. Let them disperse to every, you know, church that's willing to take them in across the country. But now we've got a gold mine here, and we can make New Orleans a city we want to make it.
Well, yeah, and they can make it a Republican city that they want to make it. Remember that 250,000 black Democrats dispersed to the state of Texas is not going to turn Texas Democratic.
Mm.
But it might well turn New Orleans and the state of Louisiana Republican.
But yeah, well,
from a purely political standpoint,
yeah, and also the senator and the governor and the mayor of that we're dealing with on a day to day basis, trusting their instincts and listening to what they have to say and trying to honor their needs in terms of, you know, representing them on our network and also trying to get them the help they need, are all Democrats.
Yes.
So it's very easy for this this group of narrow minded idiots and people that don't really care about other people, these competitive morons that all they want to do is win, to blame these particular politicians because of that. But I don't think it's going to stand, Riley, and I think that most of those voters who are going to be displaced from New Orleans can still vote in New Orleans, right?
Let's hope so.
Right,
let's hope that it happens that way.
That'll be interesting to find out. When we come back here in just a second, I want to continue this conversation throughout the day, obviously, but there's some interesting stuff about a Google. Did you read that? This new the Google World Search.
Yeah.
Something you can just download the software for nothing and look at satellite pictures of the entire planet. And apparently, it's causing some security problems in certain places. I'll tell you about that in a second. It's 47 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hey, this is Rob Zombie, and it says here, when I'm watching the sunrise after a long night of waking the dead and toasting nachos in the microwave, I listen to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
What's up, man? 51 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Where?
Yeah, right there. I see you, man. You can podcast this show, damn it.
There we go.
You can podcast it, you know, because that's one of the only ways you can hear it in a reasonable time frame on the West Coast. Now that we were bumped off the air in Los Angeles by that horrendous morning show that they play out there on our network. But you can podcast. You can go to morningsedition.com, look for podcasting information. A lot of people are doing that. It's one of the great benefits of the pod. My wife actually listens to me on the pod there. So, Kayla, what happened? You had to get a new iPod? Huh?
Yeah, I had to get a new iPod because my iPod broke. It's the battery lost its charge.
It gave up on you?
Yes, apparently.
If a little thing came in the window and said, "Your songs suck. I'm out. I'm done. I'm done."
Well, it's funny. I go to put a new song on and I press play and it just shuts off. It's like, nah.
I'm sorry. Not until you get some better.
So
taste.
What is this? Another deuce and a half for a new one? Yeah, what you gonna do?
Yeah, about $300.
Do they give you a trade-in option? I mean, it's their fault, isn't it?
Yeah, they do give you a trade-in option. It's just that mine's so old that they came out with such good stuff, and I think they're gonna come out with better iPods today.
Oh well, you know
today?
Today?
September 7th.
Are you serious?
Swear to God.
So I'm glad I bought the Mini. Maybe I made the right choice. Maybe I just dipped my foot in the water. I got the Mini, and when I finally buy a grown-up iPod, they're gonna be the best iPods ever.
Well, there are rumors that they are going to have iPod phones come out as early as, you know,
Now, there are two things going on in our listening audience right now. It's like, why are they giving Apple all this free press? I mean, there are other options. You don't have to be like everybody else.
The iRiver.
All right, the iRiver. All right, and then here's another thing. It's like, why are they talking about the hurricane? Don't they know that people are suffering? Yes, we do. And by the way, my judgmental friends out there, counterterrorism expert Larry Johnson is going to be on the air with us. He's the guy that yesterday says there is a case for criminal negligence against George Bush for not enacting his own plan, the National Response Plan was accepted and implemented by the Bush administration in December 2004, and that was designed to deal exactly with the type of disaster that is happening, you know, right here in our own country in New Orleans.
So now, does that make
and
two?
And Biloxi, I'm sorry, Mississippi,
and Biloxi,
the entire
and
Gulf
Mississippi,
region. I do not want to deny them the attention they deserve.
Now, wait a minute. Does that mean that there were two, or was the PAM scenario folded under the National Response Plan, or were there two?
Well, no, I think that the PAM scenario, these were tests.
Yeah.
I think that was part of a series of tests that the Homeland Security was conducting around terrorism. I think the National Response Plan, maybe we'll find out from Larry Johnson, how that is connected to FEMA and how it applies and what it really means. What are the implications of that? It wasn't enacted because we already know that FEMA failed. We already know that Michael Brown should be out. We already know that Chertoff is useless, that these people, you know, he should go back. He can't even get a job back at the International Arabian Horse Association.
That's Brown, though. That's
Brown, because they let him go. No, Chertoff could be, what, a judge or a lawyer or whatever.
Well, that's probably what he will end up being.
Right, but, you know, we'll get back to that. We'll get into that with Larry Johnson. He's a frequent guest on our show. He knows what he's talking about. But right now, you can have your very own spy satellite, folks. Google Earth. The satellite mapping service is available to anyone that gets online and downloads the program. Provides basically satellite pictures of the world. Now, apparently, in Seoul, South Korea, the software is causing a little security breach because they are still technically at war with North Korea. And the images that you can get right on the Google thing show details. They're satellite shots of, like, military facilities, naval ports, restricted air bases. So they're freaking out a little bit. Apparently, a foreign ministry official from that country said that the service could pose a security threat, a legitimate security threat to the country. But, on the other side of that, you can see the nuclear research facility in North Korea as well.
Hey, wait a minute. Do the Chinese know about this?
I guess everyone knows about it.
With 1.5 billion people, they probably have got more secret installations than any place else on Earth.
But I never even thought about this till I read this article, which is why they have articles, I guess. But I never even, of course, it's amazing that in the 50s you'd see these spy photographs of Cuba or whatever, and you'd be like, wow, they got things in space that take pictures of stuff on the ground. We can know everything. And now any idiot could just be like, hey, let's have a look. You know, any moron could just get,
just hit download.
How are they going to protect the world from alien invasion?
They're not.
I don't even know what that means. There are no mysteries. Then why can't they stop? There's this weird line where you like sort of, you know, Big Brother is watching us, and that's what we pay him for. I can just download it. I can be him.
Yeah, but nobody can move the water out of New Orleans without pumps.
No, and Ray Nagin is a little relieved because they did have some success in plugging that 200-foot gap in that levee or that flood wall that broke that caused most of the flooding. They dropped the Army Corps of Engineers dropped a bunch of sandbags, a bunch of concrete on there. They were able to plug it and they started pumping. And apparently there is a noticeable difference in the water level in New Orleans, and that's making him happy. It's making a lot of people happy, but people are frightened as to what they are going to find when some of that water gets lower.
By the way, are we done with hurricanes season yet?
No.
I mean, is there a possibility that there might be another storm?
There is, Riley, and that is, and hopefully you would hope that FEMA is maybe saying, well, maybe we should make note of this, that the season's not over yet.
No, just make sure Rove doesn't leave Washington.
So, when we come back, we are going to, why do I keep saying that? Because we're not leaving. We're going to be right here, but we're going to have Larry Johnson, who is, he's going to tell us about, how the president is guilty of a crime. It's 57 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Ah! 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Hey, folks, come down to the Tisch Auditorium at the New School this Friday. We're going to be performing our show there Friday morning, 6 to 9. We're going to have Senator Bob Kerry, The Daily Show, Stephen Colbert, the performance artist, I guess you would call her, monologist, one-person show person, Sarah Jones, very talented performer, is going to be there with us. We're in the same auditorium that you used to see on Inside the Actors Studio. It also serves as the site of a couple of the 9/11 commission hearings. It's the New School's Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street, just east of 6th Avenue. Make the trip, folks. Make the trip. It's going to be great. If anybody can help me, please email me at sedition@airamericaradio.com. Can my three cats that live in my apartment that never go outside on the second floor of my building get fleas? Because I don't know. They're scratching. Can someone help me? All right. Now, I wanted to tell you that Larry Johnson is going to be here momentarily on the phone with us. Counterterrorism expert Larry Johnson is going to join us. Right now, if you're just tuning in, he's also going to make a case, folks, and this is worth listening for. The criminal negligence, obviously, is vast in Katrina, but Larry Johnson's got some specific evidence about a plan that Bush put in place himself that was not followed. It's going to be interesting talking to him in just a few. Right now, if you're just tuning in, here's a few headlights of what we talked. Headlights. There's a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. The White House will conduct its own hurricane response investigation. White House officials put the best possible spin on the situation, repeatedly pointing out that no matter how bad things got, the dead did not walk the earth feasting upon the flesh of the living. Bush quickly took credit. The chief executive of Microsoft vowed to kill Google. Microsoft had tried earlier to begin legal action against Google. Unfortunately, the action was automatically terminated by Windows and an error message appeared. Google holds a significant advantage in the competition between the two companies, mostly because it sounds like a lot more fun to Google someone than to Microsoft them. Actor Bob Denver, best known as TV's Gilligan, is dead at the age of 70. Denver had lived a simple life since retiring from acting. No phones, no lights, no motor cars, not a single luxury. Wait to hear this one. No cause of death has been determined, but a preliminary coroner's report noted Denver had been beaten repeatedly about the head and shoulders with what appeared to be a captain's hat. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You should be.
I couldn't even get through that one when I read it earlier. Today's phrase just dropped in the conversation. Why did Bush let New Orleans suffer? Here's a hint, sheeple. New Orleans is known as the Crescent City. The Crescent is the symbol of Islam. And Bush is waging war against Islam. Wake up, sheeple. It's all part of the crusade. Next target, Cairo, Illinois. Oh, God. Those are your Morning Sedition clips. Now, we got a couple calls on the phone that I think are pertinent and relative to what we've been discussing this morning. Frankie, listening in Brooklyn, how are you? Good morning, Frankie.
Hey, Frankie.
Hey, what's up, fellas? How you doing?
All okay, right, man. What's on your mind?
All right. First of all, I want to say you guys are doing a very valuable service by having a station, you know.
Thank you very much.
What I wanted to say was maybe these right-wingers really do have a pipeline of God, because this hurricane is like manna from heaven for them, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, what you were talking about the displacement, you know, if they really wanted to help the people from New Orleans, I think, you know, it would have been easier to come up with a more local option, you know, for them.
Sure.
To have a place to wait until they, you know, they were able to move back to their homes.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, we should say in fairness, Frankie, that tens of thousands of New Orleans residents have been moved 75 miles up the highway to Baton Rouge.
Okay.
Which has got its own, you know, not everybody in Baton Rouge is all that pleased about that, by the way.
Sure. I mean, but, you know, all you hear about is Texas, Utah, you know, I mean, California. And once, you know, once that gets out there, that's where they're all going to flock because they think, you know, they're going to know that there's going to be, you know, provisions for them.
So how do you think it's manna from heaven in your view?
Because I could foresee, you know, New Orleans turn into a shining example of, like, another yuppie downtown city.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's, you know, what we were talking about earlier. I think that that's part of the vision, that they do see that. They're thinking like, wow, we can really develop it now. We've got a clean slate. That's a good observation. Thanks for calling, Frankie.
Thanks, Frankie. I think he's got a point. I think that when you start looking at how areas become gentrified, and certainly we've had experience with that here in the New York area, you start by leveling what's there creating something else, and you don't really worry about whether the people who were there when it was poor will still be there when it turns rich.
Or gutting what's there.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, that's what we were talking about earlier, is that, you know, in the language that Bush is using, and in, certainly in the Rove protocol of the day, which is just to, you know, talk about what's happening now, and then Bush even, like, you know, unabashedly started talking about how great it's going to be when they rebuild it without paying any heed to the pain and grieving and loss on the ground that was happening right now in the present, really shows that this is part of their vision. This is, you know, this is why you can't forget these things.
Absolutely.
You know, in the same way that, you know, we can never forget 9/11, there has to be a way that the media, that, you know, that us primarily, doesn't enable people to forget. Because as you were saying before, Riley, you know, once they get, you know, start getting repair underway and the Homeland Security Department and FEMA starts taking credit for stuff going well, even though they dropped the ball for a week, we can't let the fact become erased, culturally erased, that they failed the American people. Marie, listening in Atlanta, good morning.
Hi, Marie.
Good morning, guys. I love your show.
Thank you.
I was calling, actually, what I wanted to say is sort of related to what Frank said, which is, you know, they keep doing these news stories that make the people who want to stay there in New Orleans seem unintelligent.
Right.
Well, if you've got any houses jumping out there less than 48 hours after the storm hit, saying, we need to just bulldoze New Orleans. I mean, and that's the only thing some of those people have is the house that they managed to survive in. They're afraid if they get scattered to the four winds in the evacuation that their house will get torn down and they won't know that the government came and took it. They won't have any defense. They'll just come back upon they've got nothing.
That's right. That's a good point, Marie. Thanks for calling us. You know, I think she's absolutely right, because I was wondering that myself. And it's also about how the television depicts people repeatedly, like, you know, the whole looting question versus, you know, foraging for survival needs question is that, you know, when you watch a TV, if they keep showing people in a compromised position enough and keep identifying them as belligerent or stupid or criminals, the cultural memory starts to look at them in that way. And I, you know, I can completely identify why some of these people aren't leaving. You know, I would be frightened to leave. That's all they have, and there's no guarantee. This is like, this is worse than eminent domain, because they, you know, the government can just say, now anyone can make choices about what needs to be plowed under.
Well, you know why some of them aren't leaving, don't you? Because they've got family that they haven't found yet.
Right.
Remember that some people are there, they're stuck, they have no means of communication, they have no way of finding out. If your cousin or if your kid was out that when Katrina hit,
yeah,
and couldn't get back, where else are you going to go but to wait to see if they can get back to you?
Yeah, completely displaced. And if your home goes away, you know, then, you know,
then you got nothing.
That's right. We got to take a little pause here, because we got to get Larry Johnson on the phone, the counterterrorism expert who's a frequent guest on our show, has some great information in terms of why there's criminal negligence involved in the reaction to the hurricane by George W. Bush. 14 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Attention, mis hermanos and mis hermanas. This is Pendejo. ¡Viva la revolución! You're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning, folks. It's Mark Maron here. I'm with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Our next guest contends that the U.S. government ignored its own plan to deal with the crisis such as the one unfolding right now in New Orleans. He is a counterterrorism analyst who used to work for both the CIA and the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. He is recognized as an expert in the area of crisis and risk management. He joins us on the phone from Maryland this morning. Larry Johnson, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Great, guys.
Hey, Larry.
Thanks for joining us. Hey, from where most Americans are sitting, Larry, it doesn't look like the Bush administration had a plan, but you say they did.
They absolutely did. It's called the National Response Plan. It was drafted and finalized in December of 2004. 32 departments and agencies signed off on it. The signatures of Colin Powell from State Department and Don Rumsfeld from Department of Defense are on it.
So why, you know, in your head, I mean, you know, we're sitting here, we're speculating. Clearly there was a failure at all levels of government. You know, why didn't they engage in this plan?
Because Michael Chertoff, who took over the Department of Homeland Security, hadn't helped design that plan and apparently didn't read it or was unfamiliar with it.
Oh, my God.
It's breathtaking because when you read the plan, they actually did a good job of trying to put together what should be done in these kinds of instances. This is a failure that's so monumental because it goes to Mike Brown's doorstep as well. They had all the information they knew that they needed to start preparing, pre-positioning, and putting in place the essence of this plan. It's about communication and coordination at the state and local level, because invariably in these kinds of instances, getting somebody on the ground who knows who to call, who knows how to marshal the different resources, who knows how to, you know, to use the military term, deconflict the various folks wanting to try to help.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you do these plans, because there's always confusion. There's always chaos.
Right.
Larry, are you saying that this plan was ignored because Michael Chertoff came into that job and it wasn't his plan?
No, I think I'm saying that I don't think he even took time to read the thing. I mean, it is just there is no reasonable explanation for why they delayed, because when you go back and you look at the sequence of events under that plan, when Governor Blanco sent the letter on Saturday, August 27th.
Yeah, we have a copy of that letter.
And in that letter specifically said, we can't handle this. We need help, which is triggers a federal response according to the plan, in which the president then issues an emergency decree, which he did. That then is supposed to trigger an immediate response by FEMA. Instead, what you get, FEMA doesn't start reacting until Monday, when Mike Brown sends a memo up to Chertoff saying, well, okay, let's start mobilizing people within 48 hours. So already they're saying that they're not going to start really doing anything of any substance.
So we're 2 days in already, and these guys are still sending notes to each other. And apparently some of this work that was supposed to be done on the ground there was subcontracted as well, and that wasn't engaged.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Know, they've got all sorts of response teams, individuals who are supposed to go out immediately once they get that request from the governor. Then they've got people who are supposed to be experts that go out there. They help assess the situation. They get together and make decisions and decide what resources need to come in. And, you know, they made very clear that they needed to evacuate.
So,
and, you know, that just got dropped.
So, Larry Johnson, tell me now, you know, a lot of these right-wing idiots are accusing state officials of dropping the ball. And the bottom line is, when something like this is coming down the pike and the governor of the state has sent a request previous to the disaster happening that they knew was going to happen, it had been predicted, it's obviously a federal responsibility. That's what FEMA is for, correct?
Right. No, this is, as the governor said, we can't handle this on Saturday. So those are the magic words to kick in the federal response, as well as that plan that was devised by the Bush administration stipulates they can take proactive responses without having to worry about whether the state or local officials want to get involved. In other words, if they see an incident coming of such significance, they themselves can act proactively without having to wait for a request. So, you know, this is just... There's blame to say, look, there may be some blame to assign to state and local officials. I'm not trying to exonerate them, but the fact of the matter is Governor Blanco, despite whatever problems she may have, she did what she was supposed to do under this plan, and it was the federal response that fell short.
Now, Larry, NBC News is reporting that there was also a plan, a scenario that FEMA was supposed to have dealt with called Hurricane Pam that kind of closely replicates what Katrina actually did. This is from July of 2004. And in fact, one hurricane researcher from LSU says that people died unnecessarily because FEMA and the Army Corps of Engineers didn't take this scenario seriously.
Well, they did an exercise. That was an exercise.
Right.
And the reason you do exercises is that you test out the communications processes. You test out to find out if people know who to call, and you try to identify the issues that you're going to have to address if an emergency arises. You don't want to wait till you're in the middle of it trying to figure out what to do. And for whatever reason, they completely ignored the lessons of that. That's why I wrote that one article calling, that this is criminally negligent.
Right. Now, Larry Johnson, as a counterterrorism expert, it seems that most of the focus that this government has put in terms of Homeland Security has been on terrorist, actions. They're doing tests and taking precautions around the possibility of a terrorist attack. Now, in my instincts, when I see the mishandling in this situation, I got to ask, how safe are we on any level? These guys are a bunch of bungling idiots. I mean, Michael Brown shouldn't have a job.
Yeah, no, he should lose his job. Chertoff should lose his job. And, President Bush should exercise some leadership on that because either these guys performed to a standard he laid out or they didn't.
Well, how safe are we, Larry?
This really concerns me that we're so inept on this because we had forewarning. When terrorists strike, you usually don't know in advance. And so you're having to react immediately and there's inevitably confusion there. This time, when we knew that something was coming down the pike, we failed to react. It's cost lives. And, frankly, it sent out an image of weakness and indecision that I fear may embolden some of our enemies overseas to want to try to attack us at home in a way that they haven't been able to so far.
Now, okay, well, getting into the overseas conflict that we're currently involved in as a country, I mean, is there any way that you can connect the war in Iraq and the overextension of troops there to the response that wasn't made quick enough in New Orleans?
Well, the only connection I can draw there is we're seeing some of the same kind of incompetence and ignoring of lessons learned and planning that occurred in Iraq has now come home to the United States.
Now, what?
Look, you've got a pattern of behavior here with the Bush administration that is frankly disturbing. They're told in August of 2001, imminent attack in the United States by bin Laden, and then they don't do anything until September 10th when they convene their first meeting on terrorism, and then we get struck, and then they want to say, oh, no, who could have known?
Okay, yeah, it's scary stuff, Larry. I appreciate you filling us in here.
Hey, guys, my pleasure.
All right, Larry, take care, man. Thanks a lot.
Larry Johnson, counterterrorism expert with some grim news. I will get into a little later. We'll get into that the natural response plan and tell you the details of that weren't heated. It's 27 past the hour. We're going to have our product placement minute in just a few minutes. That's definitely worth hanging around for.
Oh, Lord.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Folks, reminder, our next live broadcast will be our biggest ever. We're going to be down at the New School's Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street, just east of 6th Avenue. We're going to have Senator Bob Kerry, Daily Show Stephen Colbert, performance artist, monologist Sarah Jones will be there. Mark and I will be there. It's going to be a big room. It's the room where they used to do Inside the Actor's Studio. That's going to be great.
So no one can get near me. So don't try to touch
me,
all right?
Come and touch Pops Riley, the Buddha. I also want to tell you right now, we're going to play a bit of a part of a show from last week that Brendan McDonald and Dan Pashman hosted, where they actually interviewed a woman from FEMA about what was happening on the ground the day the hurricane was hitting. And what you'll hear in this is that they were there. They were there and they didn't do anything. But before that, we just got another call from 6th Avenue. That's where our corporate headquarters are, saying that our show has to make more money so Riley's phone can have a dial tone.
What phone?
To make more money. So here's today's product placement minutes. So what's our product placement story today, Mark?
A jet-setting American woman was just found guilty in China of murdering her wealthy husband in a crime that included a date rape drug in a milkshake, an affair with a trailer park resident, and a decomposing body rolled up in a rug and put in a storage locker.
Wait a minute. I have two questions. First of all, how come I never heard about this?
It's been a huge story in China, Mark, but it just didn't run here.
Uh-huh. And second of all, are you wearing an adult diaper?
I sure am, Mark. It's Depend Super. Super Plus Absorbency Refashionable Undergarment, able to hold almost 4 cups.
4 cups?
Uh-huh. The prosecution said that 2 years ago, Nancy Kissel, who's now 41, killed her 40-year-old husband, Robert, by giving him a milkshake laced with sedatives before hitting him in the head 5 times with a heavy metal ornament. Apparently, she researched how to drug him on the internet.
Oh, my God. That's the worst thing I've ever heard. I guess the question I'm left with is, how did you get those Depends to fit so snugly?
Mark, they're reversible. You can slip them on like regular underwear or detach the tabs, tear apart at the side perforations, and refasten them like a fitted brief.
For double the convenience.
Prosecutors say Robert Kissel was seeking a divorce in custody of their 3 children, partly because he caught his wife having an affair with a TV repairman who lived in a trailer park near the couple's vacation home in Vermont.
Wow, sounds like a soap opera. And those Depends are really swimming.
Well, you know, I also have been working out.
You sure have, Riley. You sure have.
Nancy Kissel left her husband's body in the bedroom for 2 days before she rolled him up in a carpet and asked maintenance workers to haul him away. But she claimed she killed him in self-defense.
Man, that's really wild. So is she getting the death penalty?
Nope. It's a mandatory life sentence.
Uh-huh. And do Depend products contain latex?
No, Mark. They're all latex-free. Go to www.depend.com to find the Depend retailer nearest you or purchase their products online.
Thanks. That's today's Product Placement Minute. You can take the diaper off.
Thank you so much.
All right. Now, it's so funny, the transition from a comedy to, like, let's get back into the storm.
Serious stuff.
But the serious stuff is, Dan Pash and Brendan McDonald did a superior job last week driving this machine, and they interviewed someone from FEMA. I believe this is on Monday. Is that correct? Monday. So this
just
is
as the storm was making landfall.
This was the hour the storm was hitting. They're on the phone with a FEMA representative. Let's hear that from last week, Chris.
Cindy Taylor is a spokeswoman from FEMA. We have her on the line right now. Cindy, good morning. You're on with Dan and Brendan here on Morning Sedition. What can you tell us is going on from FEMA's standpoint as to what you plan to do in this emergency situation?
Well, FEMA's been coordinating closely with state emergency officials in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, really to lean as far forward as we can to pre-position supplies, equipment, and personnel so that we can respond rapidly as soon as the storm clears and we're given the all clear to start moving into the area.
But now, do you not have people down there right now, obviously, because the city's been evacuated?
We do actually have people in Orleans Parish working with the local officials. We have a handful of people there, but we also have personnel in Baton Rouge. We have at the state EOC, and we are working very closely throughout the state and throughout the other impacted states as well.
Now, Cindy, is FEMA modeling this on any of the previous hurricanes, like Hurricane Andrew, or is that the plan of attack?
Well, we definitely learn from every hurricane, every disaster we respond to. We have practiced, drilled, trained, and really the ongoing planning and communication that we have throughout the year comes into play at a time like this.
So how do you like that? That was Brendan McDonald on the phone with a FEMA representative last Monday. So they had people on the ground, folks, on the ground the day before. Governor Blanco had asked for government assistance. Not only did FEMA fail in getting there on time, but they had people there already, and the governor had already requested that for the help. And the mindset that I don't understand is, how do conservatives, how does the right wing blindly support this government, this administration, when they've dropped the ball on everything? This is a great indication. This disaster that's happened in New Orleans, it is a complete fulmination. Is that it, or culmination, or this is the result of Republican policy on so many levels, and the repercussions of it are going to last. Just in terms of the dropping the ball on the federal level to help these people, which is heinous, you're going to have policies, revolving around legislation that's going to not enable these people to get what they need after all this is done. There's hundreds and thousands of displaced Americans that are they're spreading out throughout the country, and the bottom line is that this government failed all of us, and that is what you see in New Orleans. And what I don't understand is, how do conservatives dismiss it. Are they that limited? Are they that evil? Are they that shallow that they can dismiss the human grief factor, the human pain factor, the fact that that this pain and death was encouraged in a way through the negligence of this administration? They're willing to just forgive that to win? I don't understand it, Riley.
Well, what I found interesting in that lady's conversation, the FEMA woman, was the notion that they had assets prepositioned. In other words, they were there ahead of time. Now, let's look at that national response plan that we just talked with Larry Johnson about in terms of what the implementation mechanisms for proactive federal response to catastrophic events. The procedures, and I'm reading from the plan, the procedures outlined in the NRP Catastrophic Incident Supplement are based on the following: the pre-identification of federal assets and capabilities, the strategic location of pre-identified assets for rapid deployment, and the use of pre-scripted mission assignments for Stafford Act declarations or individual agency authority and funding to expedite deployment upon notification by DHS.
There you go. Department of Homeland Security. That's the President of the United States, and that's in his realm of things. You morons, you conservative idiots who are using a picture of a parking lot filled with school buses to vindicate yourselves to say that, see, the local government should have done something about it. Wrong. The persons, what should have been done was the Department of Homeland Security, utilizing FEMA, should have hijacked all of those buses and found drivers for them and made this thing happen. It was their responsibility, you idiots.
See, that's what I don't understand. The woman said that this stuff was pre-positioned as the storm was hitting. So what happened to it after? If they had it all there ready to roll, why didn't it roll?
Well, I'll tell you where it is. If you want to use that picture, you conservative whack jobs, if you want to use that picture to prove anything, it's to prove that your government failed these people. They failed these people. They had FEMA people on the ground whose job it was to find drivers and to facilitate those buses, but FEMA failed, Chertoff failed, Michael Brown failed, and ultimately the President of the United States failed the people of New Orleans. It was not the local government. It was in the hands of the federal government, you monkeys. So shut your stupid traps.
See, Michael Chertoff apparently, and we don't know whether he actually read this national response plan or not. It came out in December. That's 10 months. That's plenty of time to have read
it. Why would these prideful turds read something that, it's so indicative of this administration? What Larry Johnson said is that Chertoff might not have read it because it had nothing. He didn't draft it.
He didn't draft it. I didn't do it, so I'm not buying it. And that's insane when you're talking about the potential for a natural disaster.
It just it blows my mind in that this type of disposition, this type of shameless, non-contrite inability to take responsibility for everything, just blame everybody else, blame the victim, blame the local government because they're Democrats. Let Karl Rove dictate how you think because it makes you feel good. This is fueled by pride and fueled by a type of power hunger that is not only that, they're baiting racism out of everyone with this kind of thing by blaming the victim. That's shameless. It's divisive. It's not what a government is supposed to do. A government is supposed to lead the people of this country. I got an email from a guy I've known for years yesterday, a surprising email that revealed, you know, all of a sudden you see things that you didn't see about people you've known for years. Like, I had no idea this guy was a frightened, racist person that has no understanding of what human beings go through. I'm not going to mention his name or anything, but I might read the email. But it's just interesting.
Go ahead, read the email.
It's just interesting how you see how people change in the face of anything. It happened during 9/11, too. I had no idea how many frightened racists I knew in my life.
Oh, yeah.
Until that happened.
See, these kinds of things bring out the worst in people. It allows people to make a leap of faith of seeing, tens of thousands of black people in the Superdome to getting to, black out of wedlock birth rates. Yeah. That's how some of this stuff ends up happening.
Well, yeah, read that email. And it's exactly what it's about.
Well, yeah, and they begin to associate those victims with lawlessness, with criminality, with rape, with all of these things, when it was a really paltry number of people, a paltry number of criminals who stayed behind deliberately because they were looking to take advantage of other people's misery. That's not 10,000 people. That's not thousands of people.
Right, and the rest of the criminals are in the administration waiting to subcontract building contracts and get that city back
underway. Get that money.
Without those other criminals that they're accusing of being the real problem. Look, it's 45 past the hour. I'm going to read that email in a minute. It looks like people are excited. Their phones are lighting up. If you want to call 866, what's the number?
303-2270.
It's so funny. I get so used to looking at it now. I don't know what
they
happened.
They turned it over.
866-303-2270. We'll talk to you in a second. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
CNN's 25th anniversary, Morning Sedition is proud to present Great Moments in Journalism on CNN.
You simply get chills every time you see these poor individuals. As Jack Cafferty just pointed out, so tragically, so many of these people, almost all of them that we see, are so poor and they are so black, and this is going to raise lots of questions.
This has been Great Moments in Journalism on CNN, brought to you by Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
How black, Wolf? So black.
So black.
50 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Ryle on Air America.
So black.
And that was like just something that, you know, percolated out of his head. It didn't have any hostility in it.
No.
But that is what's brought to the forefront by the media, by this administration. There is inherent racism within this administration. There's inherent classism, certainly within this administration. And if you don't think that that doesn't play in to the reaction they had to this situation, you got to be crazy. And I got this email from a guy I know, and I'll just read it to you, because, you know, I didn't know him as well as I thought. Preach it, brother. You're the best friend us conservatives could ever have. Racism? Give me a break. There is a reason the network cut that rapper off. He's referring
Kanye
to Kanye West.
Yeah.
It's because he's an idiot. Sure, he spoke from the heart of an idiot. And you are giving him validity? That's the duh part. He says the army is shooting his people. His people are shooting live ammo at rescue helicopters. His people were raping women in the Superdome. His people have a 70% out-of-wedlock fatherless birth rate. All white people's fault? Keep preaching, Maron. We'll be able to run Lassie in 2008 and win. Now, this is like such a heinous revisionist mindset that, you know, this is the type of racism that this kind of thing fuels, is to make sweeping generalizations by that like that, and to be completely unsympathetic to what's happening on the ground and understand that, of course, there's institutionalized racism in this country, number one. And number two, that's not even the issue.
Well, when you start looking at who the Bush administration is offloading the blame upon, we see that, in essence, it's two women and a black guy.
Right.
It's Landrieu, the senator from Louisiana. It's Blanco, the governor of Louisiana. And it's Nagin, the black mayor of New Orleans. Now, once you start there, it's not that difficult to start showing images of people, by the way, people in many instances who were simply milling around trying to find, you know, some relief from the heat, some water, some food for their kids. But when you start doing voiceovers on top of those images, talking about raping, talking about looting, it's easy for people to look at those images and say that the people who are actually looking for help are the rapists, are the criminals. This is a tactic that media uses all the time.
It's also a tactic the Republicans use. And the idea that, you know, the Democrats are the party of the people that don't have voices for themselves. This is the party, you know, liberals and progressive ideals are to help people that can't help themselves. We believe that government should have a place in assisting people that need the help in order to get themselves, you know, started or get themselves, you know, the assistance they need.
Well, I see, that's the thing, the interesting thing about the email to me. What does an out-of-wedlock birth rate have to do with the human suffering that this hurricane caused in the first place?
Well, look, you know, here's how Rick Santorum, who made this statement in a television interview with a Pittsburgh TV station over the weekend, this is Rick Santorum and what he thinks should be done to the people that don't want to leave their property.
I mean, you have people who don't heed those warnings and then put people at risk as a result of not heeding those warnings. So there may be a need to look at tougher penalties, candidly, on those who decide to ride it out and understand that there are consequences to not leaving.
What an idiot. You can't. That's Rick Santorum, and that's on a Pittsburgh TV station over the weekend. And obviously, racism has something to do with this. Let's take a call here from Chris in Fort Myers, Florida. Chris, how are you?
Hey, Chris.
All right. I just wanted to let people know that I myself have signed up for the Move On, Host a Family deal that's going on.
Yeah.
And we were pretty happy to get a response within 12 hours. And we looked at the phone number, and it was a local phone number here in Punta Gorda, Florida.
Uh-huh.
And we were hit by Hurricane Charlie, so we knew what people kind of were going through, so we wanted to help out.
So you were going to have a family live in your house for a while?
Yep.
Okay.
Wow. When we called the number, it was some right-wing nut job who wanted to lecture me and my family on it was these people's fault.
Why? Unbelievable.
And just wanted to know why we would get involved and why we weren't doing more in our own community when we aren't affected. We're fine here. You know, that was a year ago, and we're minus 20 feet of water, and I just don't understand where these people get off.
That's who they are.
On these people.
Hey, wait a minute. Was that Move America Forward?
It's Move On. MoveOn.org, I think, is doing a reach out in finding people homes. Isn't that what you signed up for there, Chris?
Yeah. And we put in all of our information, and we got a response back. We just figured it was a family member or a friend locally because I know they have no communication there, so we just called them back, and this gentleman just proceeded to berate us.
That's who they are. That's what they're
hard to play. But wait a minute. How did you get, when you called the number back for Move On, how did you get a right-wing nut job? There's a disconnect there.
Because our information is posted on a – I'm not sure how it works on the other end. If you're looking for a place to stay, I'm not sure how you get our information, but –
Oh, so you were put on a volunteer list.
Ah, okay. Yeah. That's what I wasn't getting.
All right, thanks for your call, Chris. Well, you know, what Chris is revealing is that this is what these guys are made out of. This is what the right wing is made out of. They are a party based on contempt, hatred, narrow-mindedness, and this idea that people are capable of surviving everything without any help whatsoever, and that's the whole idea of adapt or die. That's the whole idea of pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But this is deeper. This is just out-and-out racism and fear.
Well, it's don't help those people. Those people aren't you. Those people aren't Americans. Those people are refugees. That's the mindset that people have. Help somebody in your own community. Don't worry about them. And implicit in them is not you.
Yeah, and that is the tone of the entire sort of right-wing approach to this is that it's constantly divide and conquer. It's constantly making it more divisive. The truth of the matter is this guy is doing what an American should do. You got people from all over the world that are reaching out to these victims. You got people from all over the country that have gone down there to help. Some of them have been turned away by FEMA because they don't know what to do with volunteers or they don't have the facility in place to engage all the volunteers necessary, and obviously sometimes it can get a little chaotic, but that's the nature of what America is supposed to be about. Not about there are two Americas, but there should be only one, and this government is horrendous at governing. We're gonna stay on top of this. We're gonna talk to a Duke student that actually drove down there in a Hyundai with two friends and actually rescued some people. 57 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. Good morning. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's my buddy Mark Riley.
Hey.
We're hanging out. We're talking the talk. We're going to be at, listen to this, Friday, if you like us. And you want to come see us live, we are going to be doing our biggest live broadcast ever. We'll be at the New Schools Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street, just east of 6th Avenue. We're going to have Senator Bob Kerry, The Daily Show's Stephen Colbert, performance artist, monologist Sarah Jones will be there. This is the same theater that you've seen on the Actors Studio, the old Actors Studio show. Used to be from there. They've done a couple of the 9/11 hearings from this studio. It's the New Schools Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street, just east of 6th Avenue. That's Friday from 6 to 9 a.m. Before we get to the phones, it looks like there's somebody here that wants to talk a little bit more about what's going on in New Orleans and our reaction to it. But just a second, I got to confess something that happened over vacation, Mark Riley. When I was away, I had a barbecue at my house, And I cooked for about 12 people. I cooked a couple of tri-tips. Okay,
uh-oh.
This is large pieces of sirloin. I cooked some salmon, made some mac and cheese, and I marinated these tri-tips, Riley. I marinated them for a day in olive oil and a little mustard, some red wine vinegar, salt and pepper, garlic.
Could you resist eating them yourself?
Riley, I had to take a taste. I just had a little taste. All right, you know, I just didn't think it was right that I serve it without taking a little taste. And I didn't eat a lot, Riley.
Yeah, right.
I didn't eat a lot. I just had a bite. I just wanted to make sure it was okay for them to
all
eat
right.
it.
All right, here's your penance, pal.
What?
Your local produce section?
Yeah.
Broccoli.
For the week.
That's right.
I did have a bite, and boy, was it good. And then I had to ask myself, what am I basing my life on? But I'm back. I'm back off it. All right, folks, I had nothing but tofu and crackers yesterday, and that's not helping. Not helping anything. Here in the studio.
Sure
but
I, is.
But I, all right. Happy Boys
Club. Here I thought it was my Depends on
this. Let's change the tone back
yes.
because we are going to be talking to a student who was you know this cat Hans Buder, a sophomore student at Duke University in North Carolina, who him and his buddies went down to in a Hyundai to help out. And, you know, what people don't realize is that it's not so easy to help out. And we're going to get into that in just a second. Let's take this call from Linda in Arizona, who's been waiting on the phone there. Linda, you're angry, huh, Linda?
Oh, I'm extremely angry because we're blaming the wrong people.
Yes.
We are responsible for this because we put these people back into office.
Yes.
You look under the word employee-employer relationship, we pay these people. But we are so used to substandard performances from our elected officials that we just don't care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Why are we? Why have we become so used to mediocrity in our elected officials?
Because they promised the world and people, all the Americans are still very hopeful. We still wear those rose-colored glasses and we go, you know what, just maybe. Maybe he is going to do something. Maybe she's going to do something. But you want to know who's to blame? We are. We put these idiots back into office. When 9/11 hit, and I was there, by the way, President Bush sat there with a grin on his face reading books to the children.
Yeah, but what about the people that
did not respond in a proper
time? That's right, Linda. Well, what about people
who
didn't
put him back into office? Well, what about, the heck do you expect from him?
What about those of us who didn't put him back in office? What about
well,
the people?
Well, we were the smart ones, baby. Okay?
All right.
Need to realize
so you're
that the people,
yeah.
they work for us. And you know what? If they don't start getting their act together, and America really wants to become the land of the brave and the free and prosper, we need to call them and say, hey, hi, I pay your bills, I pay your salary, get it together or you're gone.
Yeah,
end the conversation.
They should have been gone a long time ago already, Linda.
Sure,
thank you for
see,
your
the
call.
Whole thing is,
yeah,
you look,
what,
okay,
what?
Everybody was so scared
yeah.
to put anybody in the, by the way, I'm the most democratic liberal you have ever laid your eyes on.
Yeah.
I don't care if we put another Republican in there. I don't care if we would have put Kerry in there. I would have preferred Kerry. No offense. I think he's got some good ideas.
That's no offense.
But, okay?
Yeah.
But we bought into it, and nobody, we were so scared after 9/11. We were still going to the war, and if you look it up, no wartime president, which we're technically not at war, by the way, because he's only killed, how many, 5 a day?
All right, yeah, no, okay, all right, Linda, I understand your point, and thanks for calling. What she's saying is that, yes, a lot of people made the wrong decision out of fear and out just basically that they wanted leadership, and they were paralyzed with fear. That was fabricated anyways for the most part. But I understand she's not speaking for everybody because those of us that didn't put this guy in office are twice as angry, you know, and the people that did put him in office constantly try to defend him. Now, moving back into the New Orleans situation, there have been reports that FEMA actually stopped aid from going through to people who needed it and could have been saved because the appropriate bureaucratic requests weren't made. Now, and we're seeing this as part of the great failure of this administration in terms of reacting to this tragedy is that, you know, FEMA, there's too much bureaucratic red tape. There's too, and they, despite the fact that they took days to respond to this, is that you have volunteers showing up, and they're like, well, we can't have you just going in there and helping people, even though we don't have a plan, even though we got there, you know, 3 days late, even though they had some FEMA people on the ground that weren't engaged to actually do the work because they weren't given the proper orders, even though the governor, Blanco of New Orleans, asked for help. But you get people that are going down there in waves. And you know why people go down there? It's because they desperately want to help because they see that the administration, that the government, that FEMA has failed. So these people go down there in droves, and some of them are being turned away. Obviously, you can't have chaos. You can't have people running around causing more trouble. But just to help in the evacuation, Riley?
Look, there are New York City firefighters who yesterday in New Orleans fought five fires.
Well, let's talk to this guy. We have a guest on the line who actually went down with his friends. This is Hans Buder. While much of the federal government was still figuring out how to help the people of New Orleans, our next guest, Hans Buder, along with two of his friends, drove from Durham, North Carolina to New Orleans and began evacuating people. He's a sophomore at Duke University and joins us on the phone from Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Hans. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing good.
You're tired.
I can imagine.
Now, what happened? You saw what was going on in New Orleans on TV, and you and your friends just said, we got to go?
I said, I called my roommate Sonny. He was coming out of econ, and I said, Sonny, we got to go. We got to go to New Orleans, and so I'll be there in 5 minutes.
So you took the drive, and tell us what happened when you got to New Orleans.
Well, we tried to get in on Friday three different times, and we turned back at three different checkpoints, trying to go into the city over Lake Pontchartrain and other routes. And then we went on Saturday morning. We were volunteering, picking up supplies at a TV news station in Baton Rouge. And we just sniped some press passes sniped a press pass and a shirt with the embroidery of the station and a business card. And
then
we went to Kinko's and changed the names to ours. And then we posed as journalists and got through the military blockade.
And your intention was primarily just to go help out and get some people out of there?
Right. I mean, we were watching the convention center on cable, and it would look like, and we couldn't understand why they were still trapped there with no food and water for 4 days. So we're like, we got to get there. You know, however, if we have to swim, we'll go there.
And what happened when you got there? What are some of your memories?
Just the smell was something I'll never forget. The National Guard had not yet secured the building, but we walked inside, and just the smell, and there was the carpet was soiled, feces, urine.
Oh, my God. So what did you succeed in actually accomplishing?
We brought out seven people. We brought four out that night as it was getting dark, and then we went in at First Light the next morning and brought out three more.
And they were, if I read the article correctly, these people were connected, right?
Two of the gentlemen we brought out in the morning were the husbands of two of the ladies we brought out that night.
Well, that must have been an incredible emotional event for you and the people that you helped out.
Just the car ride back, it was like a collision of two entirely different worlds. You know, here I am at Duke, and these people are just so destitute. It was incredible.
Now, Hans, once you made that first run, what made you decide to go back?
Actually, when we brought the women out, one of the guys said, give me your word as a man that you'll get them to safety and come back and reunite me with my wife. So you
were just doing the honorable thing.
I don't know, I guess. I mean, you can't turn that down, right?
Yeah, they're very true. Now, if you were there, you saw what officials were trying to do there, how would you grade their efforts?
D, C minus. I mean, it wasn't a complete failure. There were police around, and there were National Guard around, but they weren't doing the right things. And we saw 150 empty buses going out of I-10 on Saturday night as we were going in. Empty buses.
That's unbelievable. Did you get any help once you were on the inside?
No, we had to stay as press. When we had the four people in the back of the car on the first trip out, they wouldn't let us past one of the checkpoints until we pretended we were journalists again.
Outside of the people that you were able to take out of there, did you engage with any other folks that needed help?
Actually, one gentleman, 15-year-old little black kid, he had a sign that said, we need food and water. There were two young 7-year-old black boys riding around on bikes. The racial tension in the air was so palpable. It was incredible.
Racial tension. Describe what you mean.
When we saw these two little kids on bikes, they were very afraid of us. And then when the National Guard came over, they were even more afraid of them. And just the comments that you would hear from some of the people we talked to on both sides of the racial divide as we got down further south. And coming from the north, it's not something I was used to, put it that way.
Well, you know, you did a great thing, Hans, and your friends, you really set an example. And, I admire your tenacity and your courage to go ahead and not only have this experience, but to go in and actually help people is a great thing.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We just wanted to know why it took so long.
Well, you know, that's what we're all asking, and I appreciate you being on the show. You take care of yourself.
Thanks, Hans.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay, take care. That was Hans Buder, who him and his two buddies from Duke actually went down there and through a certain series of guerrilla tactics succeeded in evacuating a few people, unlike FEMA and this administration. They just couldn't understand why it was taking so long, so they went down there with a Hyundai and got some people out. Why couldn't more people do that? Why are people being stopped when they want to help out? Because there's too much red tape involved and nothing is getting done in a time frame that would stop people from dying or stop people from going hungry or starving or not getting their medicines. Look, we're going to come back with the Slander Minute in just a second. Hope you're having a good morning. It's 17 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
Let's just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
I'd like to see this band. Can I see this band? 22 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey!
What is that called? Axel Frog?
Axel Frog. F. Crazy Frog.
Axel F. Crazy Frog. You can put that on your cell phone. It was actually beat out to Coldplay on the English charts.
Yes.
It's actually called A Crazy Frog Axel F.
Yes.
What do you want way. From me? What do you think I care? The only reason that you played it was because you're going to see Coldplay tonight, and I asked if you were a woman or not. Not that you know what I'm saying, women in the, is that a pejorative sense? You know,
it is.
All right, but because that was a beat, whatever. That beat Coldplay on the English charts, and we had talked about that before. And now I've just dumped this segment in the toilet because I decided to bring our little offstage conversation on stage to make you look like a fool, and yet I'm the one that looks stupid here. Do you understand what's happening, Chris? Was this all part of your stupid plan?
What accomplished? What can I say?
All right. The recent disaster in New Orleans shined a bad light on FEMA Director Michael Brown. He underestimated Hurricane Katrina, offered no transportation to help people get out before the storm hit, and then blame the victims. Still, he may just be a scapegoat for how the federal government has degraded FEMA altogether. This is an unbelievable story, but we felt we could make it a little stronger by tweaking it on today's Slander Minute. Here's our slander correspondent, Ted Fields. Ted?
Yes. Yes, Mark.
What can you add to this story, Ted?
Well, Mark, I have it on deep polyurethane background that just before taking over FEMA, Brown's job was, get this, Commissioner of the International Arabian Horse Association.
That's not news, Ted. Everyone already knows that.
Really? I thought I made that up.
No, it's in virtually every story about the guy. See? Look at the paper.
Well, hang on a second. Just after it served 9 years as commissioner of the International Arabian Horse Association. That's hilarious.
Ted, what else have you got, Ted?
Huh? Oh, I have it on super fermented lady chondroitin background that Michael Brown has led the Cincinnati Bengals to a series of losing seasons.
What?
Wait a minute. You're thinking of Mike Brown, president of the Bengals.
Exactly. I Googled the name Michael Brown, and it turns out he owns a football team. That's something the mainstream media won't tell you.
Ted, I think it's a different guy with the same name.
No, that's a pretty unusual name. How many Mike Browns could there be? And not only that, but according to the World Wide Web, a very popular research tool, by the way, Michael Brown is also a minister in North Carolina, an aerial photographer in Wisconsin, an internationally known African-American painter in Washington, D.C., an assistant professor of computer science in Hong Kong, and a female attorney in Indianapolis named Michelle Brown. No wonder he couldn't pay attention to the hurricane. The guy's all over the map.
Ted, those are all different people.
I don't follow you.
Just tell me what else you got, Ted.
I have it on deep. I have it on deep background that Michael Brown punched a baby hard as he could, right in the stomach.
Thanks, Ted. That was Ted Fields. Ted, you're gonna be all right.
Okay, my slander stinks. I know that. You don't think I know that?
This has been our slander minute.
Nobody cares what I do. Colonel Livingston has stalkers and websites. No one pays attention to me.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you.
I didn't know it was a competition.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these characters, they don't look at him. He's thrown the headphones down. I think he's crying. Is he crying? We like you, man.
Just
give it time. Oh,
my. In the stomach, huh? Okey-doke.
Oh, boy. That was exciting.
Yeah.
The Wisdom of Crowds is the name of a book by James Zerwicki. He's going to be on here, and he's going to be on here just to talk to us about it. James is writes the financial page column for the New Yorker magazine, and he also has a lot of insight into to what's happening in New Orleans and financial implications, obviously. But I'm curious about this book, Riley, because I'm one of these guys that I've always thought that crowds were probably a bad thing.
Well,
why are you
know.
Playing that again? We got to play it again.
That's right. It's popular. What can I tell you? Maybe he can explain lynch mobs to me. That's a
well,
crowd.
That's obviously that question he's going to get a lot. It's like, are crowds good when they're Nazis? We'll ask James or Wiki after this. So stay here. It's 27 past the hour. America Radio's Mornings Edition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron with Mark Riley.
Hey,
Sarah America Radio's Morning Sedition. Kalo, do you have this CD at home?
Yes, I do.
Can you burn it for me, man? I was thinking I needed it. I forgot. I don't know where the hell my copy went. You can burn it for me?
Yes, sir.
And bring me that Eel CD, too.
Okay.
Let's move on. Our guest is our guest in the studio now writes the financial page column for the New Yorker magazine, and his book, The Wisdom of Crowds, is out in paperback as we speak. I'm holding it in my hand. Good morning, James Zerwicki.
Good morning, Mark.
Did I get the name right?
Zerwicki, yeah, it's close enough.
Zerwicki?
Yeah.
Zerwicki.
Yeah.
I don't want to screw up like I do everything else. The last book I tried to read on crowds was the Mass Appeal of Mass Psychology of Fascism by Wilhelm Reich.
Right.
Now, I'm assuming you went a different angle here.
Yeah, it's pretty much the opposite of that, I think. I think, most of the way people talk about crowds tends to be about crowds as kind of crazy or volatile. So we think about lynch mobs, or we think about, the stock market bubble is a good example. And one of the things I'm trying to talk about in this book is that under the right circumstances, crowds or groups can actually be incredibly smart.
Well, that's a qualification of the right circumstances.
It has to be the right circumstances. Okay. That's really the key. And if you can do that, if you can figure out how to do it, you can actually crowds can be much smarter than just about even the smartest person, even their smartest member.
Well, let's take, for example, what's going on in New Orleans. How could a crowd have improved the response to Hurricane Katrina?
Well, I think the best example is I'm convinced that if they had done something where they had been able to take a survey or basically ask the engineers and the Army Corps of Engineers or the people that had studied the levees what the chances were that the levees would have were going to break if you had a Cat 4 or Cat 5 hurricane, I'm convinced the number would have been much higher than what they actually got. And I just think that, in a large part what happened in Katrina was you had a bureaucracy and a huge hierarchy that just didn't get the information it needed.
And a crappy president,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, well, that's what's hard.
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of us who live in New York are contrasting Katrina to what happened on September 11th in a lot of ways. And there was certainly a lot of unease on September 11th. Certainly there was a lot of anguish. There were a lot of different emotions. But there was never the panic that we seem to have seen coming out of Katrina. What do you think the difference was?
Well, I think the biggest difference is that with September 11th, if you think about it, once it was done, it was done. In other words, the victims of 9/11 were dead. I mean, they were in the building and they were gone. And for the rest of us, there was a sense of dismay and concern and panic about what might happen. But on a day-to-day level, you didn't have that same, you know, when you went to work, you could still get to work. In New Orleans, you had this ongoing crisis. I mean, if you think about it, the city was underwater for 5 or 6 days. And I also think that people were just stuck with no help and no assistance. You know, so a lot of people have looked at New Orleans and looked at the way people behaved and seen the looters and talked about how awful things were. In some ways, I think if you look at how many people were in the Superdome, how many people were in the convention center, it's a miracle worse things didn't happen.
In the sense that, you know, people that were in a desperate situation without leadership?
Yeah, I mean, they had no leadership. There was no authority. And somehow those people managed to hang together enough so that there wasn't, you know, total chaos. I mean, the convention center, as far as I can tell, most of those people made it out perfectly okay.
It's always been my, you know, assumption that, and I'm just curious in terms of the research that you did, that people in a crowd will generally take care of one another. Is that true?
Yeah, actually, you know, that's a fascinating point because I think that is, for the most part, true. There are exceptions. I mean, it's very clear, obviously, in a riot, what happens is that, you know, once a ball gets rolling, people start taking their cues from each other. But I think in general, one of the messages of the book is that people are better at caring for each other and figuring out ways to work together.
I've noticed in my apartment or anywhere where there's a situation, like the lights go out, all of a sudden you're standing out back with a bunch of people you barely know, you see in the halls, and someone goes, so what are we going to do? And then all of a sudden you start this group think, and then a leader is chosen, and it's usually wrong, and then it becomes a disaster. But I do think that I've noticed, certainly in New York, because New York is one thriving crowd, that I have found that this is the friendliest city I've ever lived in, and that people, the myths about New York are false. In a very condensed situation where people are thrown together like they are here, they take care of each other.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I am convinced that one of the reasons I wrote the book, or I would have written a different book had I not lived in New York. Because I think that when you live in New York, you kind of, at least almost every day you wake up and you think, how the heck does this place work?
Oh, yeah.
Like, how does it work? So many people, so many different people, but somehow we do manage to work together. And I was thinking about after 9/11, the blackout.
Yeah.
You know, we had the blackout, and, you know, one of the fascinating things actually in this neighborhood here in Midtown was there were people who had cars who were trying to get home, and of course, there were tons of people walking. And what you saw was somehow, as the cars were going through the intersection, every so often the crowd of pedestrians would pause. A few cars would go through, and then the crowd
would come back.
There was no one, you know, directing traffic. But somehow,
like, we didn't need lights.
Yeah,
anymore.
Somehow they managed to make it work.
Yeah,
well,
there's a certain amount. There's a savvy to New Yorkers in dealing and navigating crowds and navigating people. And I think we sort of pride ourselves on it. And we also understand, like, slow tourists in the way. We understand how to maneuver around them without hostility.
Well, you know, I have a whole section in the book about crowds, just how people walk on the street in New York City, because there's this guy William White who is a sociologist, and he wrote a whole book called City, a lot of which was just watching people, how they behave on sidewalks. And he had this whole beautiful passage about the kind of beauty of people walking in New York City. Exactly what you're talking about, how people figure out how fast to move, you know, how to get around people without bumping into
each other. Yeah, you can do the pedestrian slalom.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Is sort of like, you know, you see the challenge, like, bing, pow, poo, and you're like, yes!
Yeah, you see the openings. I mean, and that definitely is, there definitely is something really to that.
And then there's a crowd of one walking down the middle of the street as to, so not to be jumped.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right.
Now, what are the ideal circumstances? Because obviously there's a difference between people across crowd of people looking out for each other and a crowd of people with hoods and a rope.
Yes, absolutely. There's a huge difference. I think the biggest difference and the thing that really makes a crowd smart is two things. One is that people are thinking, relatively speaking, for themselves, and that can be a hard thing. So that I actually think groups are smartest when people in them are acting as much like individuals as possible.
So you're saying when you've got a bunch of morons who are filled with hate, that generally...
That generally is going to end up bad. Bad thing, right. But the second thing is diversity. So actually you want people who really have different ideas, and then you figure out a way to put those ideas together. So I'm actually not really thinking about what happens when, you know, everyone has the same concept or when everyone is really taking their cues from each other. I think probably what happens in a lynch mob is really that people start just following what the person in front of them is doing.
Well, what about what happens when you have a government situation here that is completely political, that doesn't like to govern people, that is constantly dividing people and putting wedges in between crowds to generate a certain amount of narrow-minded contempt, that those people think that they're doing the right thing as well?
No, they do. And I think politics is the toughest question, because with politics, You know, the example I use in the book, a great example is a racetrack. I don't know if anybody goes to the racetrack anymore, but if you go to the racetrack, the odds on horses predict pretty much perfectly how likely a horse is to win, okay? Mm-hmm. So you have this random group of people who come together, they bet. They basically are predicting the future, so mm-hmm. they're able to do it. But the key is that the only incentive each of those people has is to get the right answer. No one votes, no one bets on a horse because it's a Republican horse. And the problem in politics is people don't aren't necessarily always looking for the right answer. People are sometimes looking for the answer that suits their own particular political interest, suits their own particular economic interest. So it's harder to get that good crowd behavior, I think.
But a lot of times in politics, and I think in certain situations where there's marketing involved or any type of propaganda, right. that you know you're going to have a manipulation based on exploitation of psychological processes that pollute the crowd.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, because it's obviously hard for people to think for themselves when they're constantly being bombarded with news and information,
which
and
is
especially
almost
when
always.
It's directed. Right. Yeah. That's
so
absolutely right.
we're talking to James Surowiecki. Okay, is that right?
Good, yes, on the website.
All right, the Wisdom of Crowds is the book. Now, what is really, what are you trying to do with this book? What are you trying to explore primarily?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I'm interested in is I think when we come to making decisions, we tend to, whether it be in an organization like a company or a nonprofit or the government, I think the government is a really good example, we tend to rely too much on single individuals. We tend to think if we have the right guy or the right woman, the genius, that everything is going to be okay. And I actually think that there's a lot more information, a lot more intelligence in people, in a group of people, than we give people credit for.
So a respectable collective where debate is encouraged and ideas are discussed.
Yes.
That's the optimum.
But
so when you work in most work situations, or certainly in most social situations, a lot of people want to defer to a leadership because they don't want to take responsibility.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually one of the biggest problems we have basically as a country, is that people are really unwilling to sort of offer their true opinions. It's funny, though, because Americans love to pride themselves on being individuals, right? We're, you know, we're sure of ourselves, et cetera. But when you get into organizational situations, it's so easy to basically not say anything until you know what the boss thinks.
Well, yeah, I have found that in a lot of organizational situations, all people are doing is worrying about protecting their own ass so they don't get blamed for something.
Yeah.
So if they can figure out how to cleverly displace blame onto the crowd, then everything's going to be
right. No, I think that's actually a big problem. I mean, I think it's part of what happened in Katrina, I'm convinced, is that when you had this big bureaucracy, and instead of people actually having ways of getting at all that information that was down there, instead you just have people, you know, either following rules or, more likely, just trying to figure out, well, what does the boss want me to do here? What's the right thing? You know, what's the thing that's going to keep me safest? And I think that's a huge problem in hierarchy.
So one of the situations that might be optimum in understanding crowds or at least utilizing to the benefit of the group would be to actually create an environment where people will understand that the crowd will take on some of the blame, and those scenarios need to be.
Well, I think that's actually a great way of putting it, because I do think that's one of the biggest things that we need, is basically to say, you know, this is what the group's decided, and so, you know, this is, if we're wrong, it's our responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just his responsibility, it's our responsibility.
So does that mean, if we get enough people together that don't want to pay $3 a gallon for gas, we might get the prices lower?
Well, actually, of course, that is true. I mean, if enough people actually did get together and sort of refused to pay $3, eventually the price would fall. But the problem is that people need to be willing to make that choice, need to be able to make that decision.
And they have to feel supported by it, because usually when a movement like that is instigated or that type of idea gets support, you get a lot of people who on their own, they're like, no one's going to do that.
Right.
Why the hell am I going to do
it? Well, actually, you know, there's this thing that some economists have come up with called assurance contracts, and basically this is a sort of formal way of doing it. But basically what happens is you sign a contract, you agree to do something, but you only agree to do it if enough other people have done it. So you say, I'll do this if 400 people have done it, or whatever it is.
Right.
And it tends to work, because actually it solves that problem.
I don't want to be the only guy.
Right. You don't want to commit. You don't want to be the one who... And so you say, okay, if everybody else agrees to do it, I'll do it. And it actually has worked pretty well. It's a pretty interesting idea.
Well, the book is The Wisdom of Crowds, James Surowiecki. Thank you for joining us. It's very engaging. It was great talking to you.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
We'll be back with some of some cliff notes and some closing discussion. So stay with us. I'll give you the details on our show live this weekend. It's 46 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Dateline, New York, the city we built on rock and roll. Hi, kids. This is your War on Brains correspondent, Mort Milfington, reminding you to always stay informed. And when you can't do that, try listening to Morning Sedition every morning here on Air America Radio, your Xanadu, now with Splenda.
Morning Sedition on Air America.
America Radio.
That's it. Let's land this thing. It's 50 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yep.
We're in it. It's morning's edition. It's Air America Radio. Folks, tomorrow, big announcement tomorrow.
Yep.
Big thing's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to change the face of the show.
Uh-oh.
And it's going to involve you people out there. You people.
Listeners.
But you know what? Only the ones that are willing to have a little fun.
Okay.
You know, we do have some people that aren't so willing to have fun. They don't enjoy the fun.
Well, later for them.
Fun makes them feel guilty. It's like, oh, I'm happy. That's wrong. But, look, I also want to reach out and tell people who are in the New York area or willing to fly to the New York area, as many people have
or
from around
here.
The country.
Yes.
Sure, drive down. Our next live broadcast, we got some room for you. It's going to be our biggest ever. We'll be at the new school this Friday. We're going to have former Senator Bob Kerry, The Daily Show's Stephen Colbert. Sarah Jones is going to be there to share some of her characters and voices with her. She's, of course, a performance artist and monologist. We're going to be in the same theater that once housed the Actors Studio program, inside the Actors Studio, and it was also the same auditorium where some of the 9/11 commission hearings were. It's the new school's Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street, just east of 6th Avenue. That's Friday, 6 to 9. Come on down. It's going to be harder to touch, Mark Riley, because we're going to be on stage.
That's right.
It's going to be our own little Lake Wobegon in the morning there.
Yeah.
I guess,
and we got Neil, so if anybody gets too close.
That's right. We got Neil. Neil and Neil's great. Neil's our security guy at our live performances, and the only threat that he's had is this like 80-year-old woman that just insists on writing jokes for me, but will not stop. She keeps coming. You can't, Franny, right? Franny, you can't stop Franny.
No.
I'm sure she'll be there. We're gonna have to get her on the air at some point. You know who we haven't heard from in a while? Brian from Everett.
Wow. Maybe he got a gig doing dinner theater.
I don't know what's happened to Brian from Everett. Oh, apparently he called in while I was gone and I missed it. But you know what is weird about Brian from Everett? He sent me a tape. Like when I was out in Seattle, he gave me a tape. This is a listener out in Seattle, our insomniac listener who has an inconsistent mental disposition, our songwriting listener. Apparently he calls a lot of radio stations, so I feel like he's been kind of two-timing us. I guess he's doing double time
cheater
with some of those other stations. Brendan P.W. McDonald, who is going to shortly be Brendan Married McDonald.
Man, he called in while you were gone and said that, and we tipped him to the fact that you were a little peeved at him for two-timing us.
Yeah.
I think he's preparing a song to reconcile.
It better be good. It better not have anything to do with Uranus. All right, I don't, it better be clever, Brian. You know, we're not some, shoddy AM outfit that you have to deal with locally out there.
Oh.
We are a national radio show with expectations, and we love you, man.
Yeah.
We love you. I met Brian. He came to my show the last time I was there in Seattle. Also, folks, you can podcast Morning's Edition. I can't get this through enough because this is and it's not about Apple or about the iPod. It's just about it's hard to get our show on the West Coast. Okay, in the time slot that it's supposed to be in. We are in Seattle. Love Seattle. We are there in the right time slot. I think we're still on in Sacramento in the proper time slot. But outside of that, we've been pushed off the air by, pushed back. Certainly in San Francisco.
Into the twilight zone.
San Francisco is one of my favorite markets because, I lived there for a couple years. I know the people of San Francisco love our show, but the local affiliate there made some decision to put Springer on in the morning, which upsets me, but what am I going to do? Same thing in Los Angeles. They pushed us back to put Stephanie Miller on, which I watched, I listened to 10 minutes of when I was out there. It was unbearable. But, that's what we got to do.
But you said you love Springer like you love your dad.
Yeah, I know I said that. Springer's a good guy, but, he's not a morning show. That's all I'm saying.
I don't think he would say he was a morning
show. Exactly. I love Jerry Springer like he was my father.
Frigum.
I used to love the fat guy.
All right, you want to play games?
Oh, here we go.
You want to play games there, Kalo?
Listen to the Jew go on.
I've only got two.
I used to love the fat guy.
I will not fear my meat.
I'm limited to two buttons. I need more buttons. It's all I got is free gum. And aww. I used to like, what was
don't
that?
Even get me started.
What is that? I became Liz Winstead for a minute.
Uh-oh.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. That's a blast from the past.
Yeah.
Dude, what are we doing? What's happened to the show? What's happened to the last few minutes of our show? Okay.
Should we say rest in peace to Bob Denver?
Yeah, I'm going to do it in my quick notes. I'm going to do it right now. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. The White House will conduct its own hurricane response investigation. White House officials put the best possible spin on the situation, repeatedly pointing out that no matter how bad things got, the dead did not walk the earth feasting upon the flesh of the living. Bush quickly took credit. The chief executive of Microsoft vowed to kill Google. Microsoft had tried earlier to begin legal action against Google. Unfortunately, the action was automatically terminated by Windows and an error message appeared. Google holds a significant advantage in the competition between the two companies, mostly because it sounds like a lot more fun to Google someone than to Microsoft them. Actor Bob Denver, best known as TV's Gilligan, is dead at the age of 70. Riley, I told you I'd get into it.
Oh, there you go.
Denver had lived a simple life since retiring from acting. No phones, no lights, no motor cars, not a single luxury. No cause of death has been determined, but a preliminary coroner's report noted Denver had been beaten repeatedly about the head and shoulders with what appeared to be a captain's hat.
Oh, Lord.
Today's phrase just dropped this into conversation. I'll bet Gilligan wouldn't have waited 5 days to do something about Hurricane Katrina. Wake up, sheeple. It's time to listen to the professor and not Thurston Howell III. Those are your Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. Again, Friday, we'll be at the new school. Expect to see you guys there.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, ACLU President Anthony Romero will tell us what rights John Roberts is likely to try to take away from us and what rights William Rehnquist already took away. How do you like that?
Yeah.
We do. We have a brand new Morning Sedition
Radio Theater.
So, yeah, and of course, the big announcement.
Oh, yes.
Tomorrow we are going to make the big announcement that's going to change the face of Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition history will be made. You best be here.
I'm going to go get something to eat.
Yeah, me too. I'm kind of hungry, right?
Yeah, it was fun today, Riley.
Yeah, it was. It's been... See? Stop it, LaPresso. Air America Radio.
You must have quite a package.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.